worth talking about. It sounds like old stuff that people talked about many years ago. Well, it's still interesting. So what is inflammation in the brain? Well, nerve cells in the brain, they interact with the supporting cells, the glial cells. And there are several types of glia, those that are called astrocytes because they look like stars, those that are called oligodendrocytes that provide the insulating material for the long axons, and finally, the microglia, who are the soldiers of the brain. But normally, microglia don't do much because there isn't much to do in the brain. They're supposed to sit around and watch and see that things don't go wrong because we're not supposed to have infections in the brain. It's supposed to be a quiet, non-inflamed organ. If we have infections, we don't feel well, actually. But occasionally, the microglia jump to life and watch carefully. They do things like this. They're then called activated microglia. And activated microglia are not as nice as the gentleman there in the booth who was just standing still. The analogy would be they are potentially toxic soldiers with their gas masks on, and they produce all these nasty things, lots of nasty molecules that are related to inflammation that can hurt your nerve cells. They might be important to get rid of an infection of some sort, but they can also hurt your nerve cells, and they can cause neuronal cell death. So for that reason, it might be interesting to reduce the inflammation, which we know is going on in Parkinson's disease as part of the process. It could be in response to that alpha-synuclein molecule that's swimming around outside the cell, but perhaps reducing this would be good. The evidence for that is sort of circumstantial, and there is an interesting epidemiological study where they followed 136,197 healthcare professionals in Boston, and they looked at who got Parkinson's disease and related that to how much anti-inflammatory drugs they'd taken. And interestingly, if you look at the patient, or not the patients, the people who'd taken a lot of ibuprofen during their lives, their risk of developing Parkinson's disease was statistically significantly lower than the other groups, those who were taking other types of anti-inflammatory agents. And we also know that if you measure inflammation in the spinal fluid of patients, the cerebrospinal fluid, this is actually work involving the better Brundin in Parkinson's research, my wife, Lena Brundin, and she's a psychiatrist. She takes care of me when I come home. She is interested in depression. And they looked at a cohort of Parkinson patients in their spinal fluid. And what they saw was that there was a correlation between signs of inflammation, I'm not going to go into the details here, but non-motor symptoms such as fatigue and depression were correlated with various parameters that indicated there was inflammation in the spinal fluid. So the bad soldier might be causing some of the non-motor symptoms. So that's a take-home message that whilst we're thinking about helping Parkinson patients, we have to think about all these mechanisms because they might address different types of symptoms. Slowing down the disease with antibodies against alpha-synuclein, perhaps treating some of the non-motor symptoms with anti-inflammatory agents, or even slightly reducing the risk of the disease with anti-inflammatory agents. So all of these three have to be thought of, and I'm going to explain soon one approach to improving energy use in cells. But one question that you might have asked yourself is, when does it start? When did it start in you? And most patients will be able to say, I was diagnosed in such and such a year, but I know something wasn't quite right 5 years before that, or 7 years prior to that, I could no longer smell the pizza. So we now have understood, once again in the last 20 years, that the disease process is very slow. And there are really three things telling us that the disease process probably starts much earlier than we used to think it started. So when you come to the doctor and you're diagnosed, it's been going on for quite some time. And the loss of sense of smell occurs in most patients long before they have problems moving. And we know that that could be related to this Lewy pathology that's found in the olfactory system in the brain, at quite a high level in Parkinson's disease, and it's believed to be one of the first places that the Lewy body pathology develops. We know that constipation affects many of the patients before they are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And we also know that a strange sleep disorder called REM sleep behavior disorder is very, very common prior to diagnosis. And this is where patients have disturbed dream sleep, and they live out their dreams, and they talk, and they fight in their sleep. The patients might not know about this, but their spouses frequently know about it. So we have also learned just in the last couple of years that to some extent the degeneration of the dopamine neurons is quite advanced by the time the diagnosis is made. And we're beginning to understand that we have to look at the terminal end of the long branches that nerve cells make. So at the end of the axon, there are clear deficits in almost all of the axons of the dopamine neurons already 4 years after diagnosis has been made. So these are sections through brains of different patients. This is a normal individual. This is 1 year after diagnosis in Parkinson's, 3 years and 4 years. And if you asked me, once again, 10, 20 years ago, we would have predicted that at 4 years there was still a lot of this brown, gray stuff left there, but it isn't. So the axons are failing. They might still be there, but they're not feeling very well. So we need to model this, and I think we are well on our way to getting better animal models. We're able to mimic this slow degeneration. We're able to, in animals, now start a degenerative process at the end of the nerve terminals, and it'll look at it as it develops back towards the cell body. We're learning more about this premotor phase. We're looking at loss of olfaction in mice and rats as a potential sign of a Parkinson-like damage, and we're looking at depression-like symptoms in animals, and we're doing all of these sorts of things that we were not even thinking of 10, 20 years ago. Hopefully, this is going to teach us which drugs are the best ones, because we can test them in these refined models instead. And maybe this synuclein transfer modeling that we've been doing in the last 8 years is going to be a key to new drugs, because we had no idea about this before. Now, in the lab, we're screening for drugs that stop the uptake of synuclein. If we get a hit there, possibly this could be used in patients in a few years from now in trials. And the idea of targeting inflammation and energy failure is also key to this. But taking drugs to patients is a challenge. And I shouldn't pretend it's something you do, you know, 1 week, oh, I just discovered a drug in mice. Next week, trying it in patients. A year later, we're selling it in the pharmacy. This is a very, very prolonged and much more difficult process than that. And there is something that is called in the pharmaceutical industry the valley of death, the translation gap, where you have to go from the mouse and the cell culture in the laboratory to a successful clinical trial, where most of the trials fail and the cost is unbelievably high. CNS drug discovery is particularly expensive. They take about 35% longer to develop than your average drug, so some cardiac drug, for example, because doing work with the brain is very difficult. It's difficult to take biopsies from the brain. You don't do that because you destroy it and so on. So it's just a very challenging organ to work with. And only about 8% of the drugs that looked like very strong candidates at the beginning of this pipeline actually make it to the end. So imagine 92% fail. And the cost, if you include all the failures, of getting one successful drug in the nervous system for nervous system disease is in the range of $5 billion. That's a crazy amount of money. So those failed vaccination trials in Alzheimer's disease, I think, came up to about $2 billion, just those trials there. And now they have fortunately been able to rethink their strategies. But it's led to a lot of pharmaceutical industry becoming afraid of working with brain disorders. They're sort of pulling back. So neuroscience under threat as big pharma backs off. And we don't want that. We want them to still be interested. And I say we, the academic research community, Parkinson's UK, Arthur Roche, who's here, who's leading their scientific charge, trying to help bridge that gap. And one way of doing this is using known drugs for new diseases. Could be cheaper, certainly will be cheaper if it works, and maybe faster. So what do I mean by this? Who's heard of a drug called Viagra? Viagra was actually not developed for the thing that it's being used for right now. This was a side effect in a clinical trial that some people noted, and I think some people were happy about this side effect, and certainly the drug industry found it to be a very interesting side effect that they then pursued and developed a drug. Now, that was a chance finding. The Cure Parkinson's Trust, which is the sister organization of Parkinson's UK, wants to push these sorts of trials. They talk about greater urgency, transition from science to clinic, and they've developed a program called the Link Clinical Trials, which is a drug repurposing program. I'm fortunate to be part of this. I'm on the scientific committee where we look at these drugs, and before I joined the committee, even they had started looking at the idea of treating energy deficits. And they had the idea that since there is an energy deficit in Parkinson's, there are certain drugs that, as one of their effects, improves energy utility in cells, and these are anti-diabetic drugs. And they took a drug called exenatide, which has many effects. Just to show you how many, it looks like this. This is the effect of exenatide in a cell. So I'm not going to go through that. But they thought that this might be an interesting drug to try in Parkinson's. So they did this, and they tried it in a group of patients with mild to moderate disease, and they gave them injections of exenatide, and they had control patients who didn't receive injections, and they followed them, and they looked at their disability on this rating scale, and they saw the exenatide patients, after 12 months of treatment, were significantly better than the controls. Then they stopped treating. So they washed out the drug, they waited for 2 months, and after 2 months, there was still a difference. And then they followed them for another 12 months, and lo and behold, there was still a difference after 24 months. Treatment only for 12. What's that telling you? Maybe those injections, and I say maybe because it isn't a fully controlled trial yet, maybe those injections modified the cells, improved their energy utilization in a more long-term fashion, and maybe recovered some of the structure, the axons that are failing due to energy failure. So this whole notion is very exciting, and we have this committee, as I said, and we're working now on many candidates. We've gone through about 100 drug candidates. We sit for a couple of days every year and look at the top 20 for that year. So over the 100 drugs, we currently have about 10 that we're pushing into clinical trials. And just to give you some examples, some are things such as a mucolytic drug used to get rid of mucus in your lungs when you need to cough, or another anti-diabetic drug that's similar to exenatide but maybe better, and another mucolytic drug called N-acetylcysteine. And the exciting thing, these are all pushing into clinical trials. It's so exciting that the Van Andel Institute, where I work, has signed an agreement with the Cure Parkinson's Trust, so we're going to sponsor for the next 3 years some of these trials, and some of them will now take place in the United States. So it's both sides of the Atlantic working together, which is exactly how it should be. Now, Tom Isaacs, I told you, is a great patient advocate. He wrote to me almost to the day 1 year ago, an email, 23rd of April last year, and he wrote, "People who live with Parkinson's are faced with a slow loss of control of life. The principal medicine is encapsulated in one word, hope. The moment you're diagnosed, the sand in the hourglass starts to run. The urgency required to maintain hope intensifies. The only way that the hopes of new treatments can be realized is by the conduct, management, and success of clinical trials." And I thought this was very inspiring. And Tom said, "I want to help remove some of the hurdles for clinical trials." So Tom wanted to organize a workshop at the Van Andel Institute, September, same year, a few months later, where he wanted some patient advocates to get together and discuss how can we facilitate patient enrollment and minimize those hurdles, make them smaller, and get more clinical trials underway. Because maybe there is that magic mixture of drugs that will help. We do several trials. So our meeting was called Grand Challenges in Parkinson's Disease. It was a purely scientific meeting, but Tom is a very persuasive man and a very likable fellow, so he convinced me we're going to do that extra workshop on the side. So on May 15th, we announced we're going to have this little workshop that we called Rallying to the Challenge, tying into the name of the scientific meeting. So these 15, 20 people would be primarily patient advocates, and they were going to organize this for patients, but have some researchers, clinicians present, and try to increase participation in clinical trials, and also give people with Parkinson's disease, because that's the right terminology, it's just hard to say, people with Parkinson's disease a unison voice in the discussion about how trials should be performed. How can we get everybody involved and on board? And it happened. They had this meeting, but there wasn't 15 people, it wasn't 20. They ended up being 100 people. Tom Isaacs, Steve DeWitt, who's a leading patient advocate in the US, who went to the White House 5 weeks ago as an advocate for Parkinson's. We had a former NBA basketball player who's got Parkinson's disease, Brian Grant. He's got his own foundation. Does not give out grants, but he's called Brian Grant. Lots of people who are really strong, and I think this really summarizes this. No decision about us without us. And as a result, they wrote a manifesto that's published as a scientific paper. It's out online now in the journal of Parkinson's Disease. Look at the authors. None of them are formerly researchers. John Stanford used to do research. Sonia Mathur is a former MD. Steve DeWitt, you saw the picture of. Israel Robledo is another leading advocate from the US. Tom Isaacs, I've introduced to you. They're all people with Parkinson's disease who are now helping, partnering with the scientific researchers to get more trials done. And they talk about 45% of clinical studies are delayed because there isn't sufficient enrollment of patients. And that 80% of people with Parkinson's are actually interested in clinical trials, but only about 10% have ever taken part. So I think there's something to learn here, and I'm ending with this message that we're in this together. So we're working in the laboratory with the cells, with the animals, with the patients, doing trials, but we also need the patient community to engage, and I know it is doing this, and we need to be receptive to the message that the patient community is sending. So we're continuing this dialogue and this collaboration, this partnership. So Grand Challenges in Parkinson's Disease this year is focused on the role of alpha-synuclein in the disease, that little horrible protein. But we're also, if you click on that thing there, it says rallying. Click on that. You see we're organizing Rallying to the Challenge again. And we're now going to focus on what are the most important, most relevant outcome measures. What really matters to patients in clinical trials? So we don't measure some uninteresting, irrelevant thing that you can measure in the laboratory because we can measure it. Let's measure something that matters to patients. And let's focus on things that can measure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the effect of the drug. And as you can understand, we're thinking a lot about wearable devices. You've heard about Apple launching an app for Parkinson's disease. We're going to have participants from Google come to this meeting. So I hope this could be very interesting. Max Little is likely to come and talk about his voice app too. So on this note, which I hope has some optimism in it, I want to say, almost the end, I want to say first, thank you for listening, but also that this isn't a six-year war, and it isn't quite the end yet, but surely there must be cause for more optimism than there was 20 years ago when my father was alive. And, you know, when you do research and do other things in life, despite what Winston Churchill said, you have to begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end. Then you can stop.